Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. Dennis, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, tired dad?
I'm doing all right.
Tired dad number one. Here's tired dad number two.
Exactly. Hattie has decided to wake up, you know, after 5 or so hours of sleep, which means I've had maybe about 2 or 3 hours of sleep. We've been trying to, because Jess usually wakes up a little earlier with her. So I'm the one that gets up with Hattie in the middle of the night, and it has definitely started to take its toll. And today was just a long, busy day in general. But that's okay, because now I get to talk about Quantum Leap.
Yes, we're talking about Roberto!
Roberto! Exclamation point.
Yes. I'm excited about this episode. I think I said last episode, it's probably at least 15 years since I watched this episode. So I remembered the broad strokes, and you were saying off mic before we started recording that you remember this episode being kind of cheesy, and it is cheesy, but it's a really good episode, so I'm looking forward to talking about it.
It is a really good episode. I think, you know, that there's some scenes early on that really, really sell it for me, and the relationship between Sam and Janny is really well done. Yeah, there's a lot to like about it. It's funny because two things that stood out for me before I did the rewatch, and I hadn't seen it probably in about, you know, 10, 15 years either. But I know I saw it a few times back in the 90s, in addition to its initial airing. The chemical plant scenes and the inhaler. Both of those things kind of stood out to me and immediately, like, came back to me as I was watching again. But yeah, let's just dive right in. So Roberto is directed by Scott Bakula.
Have we seen him on the show before?
You know,
he sounds familiar.
This is actually the second of three episodes that Scott will direct. Prior to this, he had directed Permanent Wave. He'll go on to direct Promised Land in the fifth season. Our writer is Chris Rupenthal, which is a name, of course, we've heard many times.
Rupen Boogie.
That's right. In addition to being an executive producer on the show, he has also written a total of 10 episodes. This is his 9th episode out of the 10. We're going to start to see that more and more often now, you know, as we get into the home stretch. The bulk of everybody's work is behind them.
Yeah.
Other episodes, of course, that he's written, the great, excellent, awesome, perfect introductory episode, if you don't want to start at the very beginning, Good Morning Peoria.
Yep.
Of course, you'll be skipping a lot of really great episodes if you do that, but hey.
Sure.
Also responsible for Animal Frat, Freedom, another favorite of the show here, One Strobe Over the Line, The B-Man, Glitter Rock, Hurricane, Last Gunfighter, and the upcoming Curse of Tahotep will be his final writing credit on the show.
And we got to say, I also think he wrote, if not the music, he at least wrote the lyrics for I'm Just a Traveler Upon the Sea. Yeah.
And if you stick around past the credits, you will be able to hear you, a little bit of
like that. We do every episode until Universal shuts us down. Sends us a C&D. Stop playing that iconic Emmy award-winning song.
I'll tell you what, it's one of the benefits of flying under the radar, as we do. You know, we can get away with throwing a minute and a half of copyrighted music on the end. Of course, now that I've said that, we're getting that CD. Somebody's like writing an email right now to Universal, like, did you know these hacks, these Star Trek podcast wannabe actors have your song?
Yeah.
So our air date for Roberto is March 11th, 1992, and the leap date, almost 10 years prior, January the 27th, 1982. Sam has leapt into Roberto Gutierrez, and our location is Destiny, New Mexico.
Ooh, and we'll come back to that later.
We shall. Take us away, Dennis.
Let's talk about the TV Guide description. Sam reports as the host of a tabloid talk show, and he sniffs out a dangerous story with another reporter, played by Delaine Matthews.
Well, fairly straightforward.
That's pretty straightforward. Let's talk about what this episode was called in other countries. This is pretty straightforward, really. In France, it was called... And that's the interesting one. Let's jump ahead to the boring ones. In Italy and Germany, it was just simply aired as Roberto.
All right.
And in but France, it was called The King Live.
The King Live?
The King Live.
Okay.
And the only thing that's popping to me off the top of my head is some weird comparison with Larry King. Because I think he just got his CNN show like within the last 5 or 7 years at the time.
Yeah, maybe. Back when he was 95.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God. You were around the Indianapolis area for a while. You lived there for a while.
I was. I lived down there for almost a decade.
Were you aware of Bob and Tom, the morning radio show?
Yes, sir.
Did you ever hear any of the sketches they did with Larry King, mocking Larry King?
God, I don't know if I did. I didn't really listen to them, but it was hard not to be aware of them.
It was, regionally, like, they would sell, like, just, like, CDs of the best of their morning sketches.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I would buy the CDs and just listen to the sketches. They had their Larry King character was something. And yeah. I can't remember, the only thing I can remember is some bit where, like, because the bit was like Larry King would call into the Bob and Tom radio show. And I just remember one bit of him calling in and talking about going out and splitting wings with B. Arthur, and B. Arthur goes to grab the last wing, and he's like, "Not today, bitch!" And I clocked her.
Oh my God, it was just weird.
Yeah, it's just weird stuff out there like that. Yeah. Anyway, also of note, this episode had a rating of 10.2 million viewers.
Yeah, puts it kind of, you know, towards the bottom of the middle of the pack for season 4.
Yeah. Chronologically, it falls in between. Sam most recently was...
Another mother,
just like 4 months before in September of 1981. He would next be seen in Odyssey, which was one of the novels, which took place in January of 1983. Sam's next leap in time in the TV series would be June 1983, Permanent Wave.
Yeah, nice little clump there. So this episode, let's talk just a little bit. We won't go into, you know, we won't get exhaustive with these names, but let's talk just a little bit about our three big guest stars here, and start with Delaine Matthews as Janie. She's great in this episode. I really enjoy her quite a bit. I think the chemistry between her and Scott is great, and you know, there's kind of almost screwball comedy romance vibe between the two of them early on, you know, something like Tracy and Hepburn or Cary Grant, you know, that sort of thing, which is great. She is probably most known, if you can even count that, for playing the wife on the television program Dave's World.
That was a good show.
It was a good show, actually. It did get some good critical acclaim. And, of course, starred the... I can't believe I'm saying this, actually. As it's about ready to come out of my mouth, I'm kind of like, man, it's weird to say this. excuse me, but the late, great Harry Anderson.
I was just reminded of that recently because I saw It, Chapter 2, a couple weeks ago. And he was Richie in the original 1990 TV miniseries. And I was looking... And so Betsy and I have been slowly watching that the last few nights, the original miniseries. And, yeah, so looking stuff up on that, I was reminded that, yeah, he passed away a few years ago, unfortunately.
And, of course, you know, neither here nor there, but... might as well mention it since we're talking, and it's us. In addition to it, of course, also well known for Night Court,
sure.
which ran for 8 years. Amateur magician.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not about him. He's not on the show. Delaine Matthews. she's got a ton of credits going up until about 2012. And then IMDb kind of trails off. But I'd be shocked just based on the length of her resume if she wasn't working somewhere doing something, in some capacity.
She was on 3 episodes of The Shield.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I'd be hard-pressed. It's been years since I've watched that show. But, so I'm going to jump back and say, you said that you really like her and Sam's relationship in this episode.
Yes.
And as a counterpoint, I don't.
Really?
I like their episode in the second half when they drop the antagonism. And here's why it doesn't work for me as I'm thinking about it, is that we've had plenty of episodes where Sam is paired up with a woman who naturally rubs him the wrong way. His boss, Patricia, I can't remember the character's name, but Patricia Richardson in Good Morning Peoria.
Sure.
The Bounty Hunter episode.
Mm-hmm.
This episode...
I mean, there's quite a few, yeah.
Yeah. There's quite a few where we follow that trope. This episode, I feel like he's kind of indifferent to her, but Al eggs him on and says, no, you have to be antagonistic because that's who Roberto is.
Yeah.
And, like, Sam is phoning it in, and, like, he's being antagonistic because that's what Al tells him to do, but, like, he's not, like, genuinely really annoyed with her in the first half of the episode. I like their dynamic. I like, after the plant worker, after he gets killed in the hit and run, and, like, where their relationship goes after that, I really like.
Yeah.
But until then, I'm just kind of indifferent to their shtick.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know. For whatever reason, I enjoyed it. That's a trope I enjoy. You know,
you're not wrong. I'm just saying that. Yeah,
right. And I think I think it's funny because almost for some of the reasons that you don't like it, I do like it. Like, I do enjoy the fact that Al has to kind of push him into it a little bit. I think that one could easily make the argument that because Sam's just been headbutted by the Führer, as he puts it, that he's he's a little out of sorts, off his game. So maybe, who knows, maybe that's playing some sort of effect with him not giving it right back to her and needing Al to step in and help him out. I don't know, but I definitely agree with you that the turn the relationship takes after they come upon the hit and run scene is really great, and the conversation they have, which I want to talk a little bit more about when we get there, is fantastic, and I love Sam's response to her when she asks, why did you do it, or how did you get into this. So, in addition to Delaine Matthews, we've also got Alan Oppenheimer as Earl Skinner, who is, of course, the editor-in-chief, if you will, the boss. And he, again, just, resume a mile long on IMDb. I think that the two things worth pointing out here are that he was the original Dr. Rudy Wells on the $6 Million Man before Martin E. Brooks took over. Most people would recognize Martin Brooks as Rudy Wells, but it was Alan Oppenheimer that actually originated the role in the original television films and in the first season, which was truncated compared to the other seasons. And of course, the one thing that any child of the 80s would certainly recognize him for, that's nothing to do with his face and all to do with his voice. This gentleman was the voice of Skeletor on He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Oh my God, he was.
Yeah, and he has a ton of voice acting credits. And right up until today, guy's still working. He's almost 90 years old, and he is still working to this day. He actually voiced Skeletor 3 years ago in a short film, and has continued to do so for a number of years. He was also in Toy Story 4. And again, just a huge list of credits in both voiceover work and film and television. Actually played two characters in The Practice, which I know we've talked about a little bit before on the show in relation to Boston Legal, but and of course, you know, we wouldn't be a good sci-fi podcast if we didn't mention that he also has some Star Trek connections, Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Star Trek The Next Generation. But yeah, a career that has spanned, I mean, let's see, started in 1963, so 56 years worth of credits. So definitely a guy that you might recognize, if not his face, then his voice.
One thing, speaking of the voice of Skeletor, if you or any of our listeners, if you have not discovered this page, they're not publishing anymore. They stopped publishing about 4 or 5 years ago. But go check out the Facebook page, Skeletor is Love. it's someone, it was she took like screen captures of Skeletor from the original Masters of the Universe cartoon, and she put affirmations over the top of them.
Oh man.
And it's just like you just read those in Skeletor's voice and they are amazing. So go check that out. Also, I didn't realize so Alan was in Westworld, which was a Yul Brynner 1973 movie, and apparently that's what the HBO series is based on or off of that, and I had no idea.
Oh really? Yeah.
Not a clue.
Yeah, it's funny because if I'm not mistaken, the film was actually based on a concept short story novel something that, by Michael Crichton, who of course is also known for Jurassic Park and Rising Sun, etc. But anyway, Alan, obviously, lots of credits, just a Hollywood stalwart to say the least. And then, of course, another guy who's been around for a very long time and is certainly recognizable to any sci-fi genre fans is Jerry Harden, who plays Ed Saxton, the evil chemical weapons manufacturer. And I think most people would recognize him, of course, for playing Deep Throat in The X-Files, which, you know, I don't think there's any understating his importance as an actor, as a character, etc., to the evolution of that show, in spite of the fact that the character is, you know, is bumped off fairly early. But just an excellent character, great actor, and he's, again, been around for a long time, done tons of film and television, going all the way back, believe it or not, to 1958.
Wow.
He was in the film Thunder Road, which is a great Robert Mitchum flick.
Robert Mitchum.
Yeah. just a quality talent, and still around, still working. I think his most recent credit would actually come. He's got something in post production right now. He's playing Mark Twain, actually, in a television movie called At the End of the Santa Fe Trail.
Imagine that. See, because immediately, the minute he popped on screen, even though when he played this character, he was under a ton of makeup, I instantly recognized him as playing. He's credited as Samuel Clemens, not Mark Twain, but playing Mark Twain in the two-part Next Generation episode.
Yeah.
Time Zero.
That's right. Yeah. Which is actually, funny enough, was not his first go-around on Star Trek Next Generation, because he was in an episode, I think, in the first or second season as well.
First or second season, we almost don't count that.
Well, yeah. That's very true.
You know, yeah.
But anyway, we'll talk a couple more, you know, guest actors here when we get to them. But let's dive in. We've got a longer leap in as we generally do with most episodes. There's a little bit more pushing and shoving, nothing of substance really, but there's a little bit more pushing and shoving before Sam gets the headbutt. Once we come back from the credits, as Sam has to do the outro for the show, a couple of things stood out. One of the topics in an upcoming episode, Sunday school teachers for marijuana, which I just love.
That jumped out at me, yes.
And as he talks about the, you know, the bikini models, nude models, whatever, you hear the biker dude that had headbutted him. He's like, "Yeah, I'll watch that one.
Yeah, I'm in, I'm there for that one."
Yeah. And so I just kind of love how, like, and I'm sure Scott had to have encouraged this, that there's life happening. You know what I mean? Like, kind of off screen. Like, sure, we're not seeing this stuff at all. But that that as these guys are getting kind of carted off after the headbutt and all that jazz, that they're still in the scene, which I really loved.
Yeah, it was good quality textbook Quantum Leap opening first scene.
And I think that continues on with a disoriented Sam, you know, as he goes through the newsroom and, you know, is maybe mildly concussed. Al shows up fairly early, you know, which is not always the case, but we get Al early on, and he kind of helps Sam navigate the waters a bit, lets him know who he is. I think this is when we get our first mention of Geraldo.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's... Dennis, what? I said this to you before off mic. I just want to say it again. Do we have to?
Let's just hit the highlights. Here's my favorite tidbit of Geraldo Rivera. That's not his real name. He is not Hispanic. He is Caucasian, as you and me. Do you know why his name is Geraldo Rivera?
I don't.
When he was coming up through the ranks, young news reporter trying to break into the business, it was at a time particularly where they were trying to find more diversity than just straight up white guys. Mm-hmm. And somehow he discovered that if he grew a mustache, he looked Hispanic.
Oh my God.
And I'm not even going to bother looking up what his real name is. So he grew a mustache, he changed his name to Geraldo Rivera, and all of a sudden he was a non-white news anchor that networks were looking for at the time. That says everything about his integrity that you need to know.
Yeah, right. Here's something interesting, actually, though. I think it is worth noting here that his real name is Gerald. Gerald Michael Rivera. The funny thing about that is apparently the extra I in there was added by mistake on his birth certificate, and his last name really actually is Rivera, because his dad, his name is Cruz Allen Rivera, who was a Puerto Rican Catholic descent.
Okay.
But his mother was of Russian Jewish descent. He was raised mostly Jewish, had a bar mitzvah, all that jazz. So he was certainly raised, you know, in that world, if you will. But yeah, he did. But you're right. He did indeed change the name. He didn't like his name being Gerald. He thought that Geraldo, he wanted something more identifiably Latin, Latino. So he did that. Interesting to note also that in the early stages of his career, you know, he did break into the business in a more serious manner. One of the, you know, his early stories in 1972 won a Peabody Award. It was a report on the neglect and abuse of patients with intellectual disabilities at Staten Island and the Willowbrook State School. So he started to appear on programs doing kind of investigative journalism like that. It didn't last long. And of course, then he started to slowly but surely tackle all sorts of controversial topics.
I should say, I misspoke earlier when I said Hispanic. That is, you said Latino, and Hispanic and Latino are not the same thing.
Right.
They're often used interchangeably, but that's wrong. So, yes, I wanted to correct myself there. Sorry for that flub, but yes. But yes, he goes into basically what he's being made fun for of in this episode. And Chris Rupenthal has flat out said that that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
They weren't hiding it.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know for certain, but I cannot necessarily find... not that the episode makes direct reference, except for Al, to Geraldo. But it seems that most of his more sensationalistic stories didn't start until the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. So this episode kind of predates a lot of the more sensational stuff that he did, including the Al Capone Vault, which I know you want to talk about. And
I don't want to talk about it. I feel like posterity, we do have to talk about it,
right?
But I don't. Well,
because there are two. There are two things that happen in the course of this episode that are direct references to things that happened to Geraldo. One is, of course, getting headbutted by who appears to be, although he's never identified as such. In fact, he's more alluded to be some sort of, you know, cult worshiper. But certainly appears to be some sort of white supremacist, and Geraldo was indeed punched by a white supremacist on his television program at one point. And then, of course, take us to the story of Al Capone's vault.
I'm just going to hit the highlights. Basically there was, this was a live broadcast, April 21st, 1986, it was a hotel in Chicago where he promised that they had found some vault, and they were potentially, there were going to be some hidden great riches in there, or maybe some dead bodies. They had a medical examiner on hand in case any bodies were found. They had someone, they had agents from the IRS ready to collect any money that was found in the vault. And then when the vault was finally opened, the only thing that they found were dirt and some empty bottles, including one Ribera claimed was for moonshine bathtub gin. There were several attempts to dig further into the vault. And then finally, Geraldo admitted defeat, voiced his disappointment, apologized to the excavation crew for their efforts, and that was that. When he was recounting this 30 years later on the Fox News channel, he admitted that as soon as they went off the air, he went across the street and got tequila drunk. But then by 5 years later in his autobiography, Exposing Myself, he soon realized that this was not the end of his career, but the beginning of it.
Yeah.
For what it is worth.
Yeah. Yeah, and now he's just another dirtbag talking head on Fox News for what it's worth. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But at the time, you know, he was mostly just someone that you either loved to hate, rolled your eyes at, or tuned in and watched with bated breath as he took us down the garbage chute of daytime television.
Yep. So there you go. Now we have officially talked about Geraldo Rivera.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're going to get to do this later with somebody else, but we'll get there.
All right.
So at this point, you know, Sam meets Janie and they have their exchange, and Al helps to kind of punch things up, as we mentioned earlier. And part of the exchange between the two of them as they egg each other on is that she thinks that he can't cover a serious news story. And so they make a bet. And they take a phone call, and they're off to the races. And when they get there to interview this character, he starts telling them as he waves a shotgun in their face that he saw aliens.
Red Norton.
Yeah.
That's it. And it physically, he looks like a good mix between Red Skelton and Ed Norton from The Honeymooners.
Yes. As so, played by Dennis Fimple.
Mm-hmm.
Character actor, even though I hate that word. He'd been around for a long time before his passing, dating back to the late 60s, lots of television and film. He fits the role so perfectly here, and I think that the result of the conversation that he has with the two of them really does help to add a little bit to the tension. Because the interesting part is that he's telling them a story that fits perfectly on Roberto's show, while at the same time giving them just enough to kind of follow the breadcrumbs elsewhere. And so it's clear that Janie doesn't think that he's going to be able to, you know, to actually come up with a serious news story, that it's going to be all about the fluff of, like, I saw aliens killing sheep in my backyard.
Yeah. But it's, you can't help it, towards the end of that scene, I think Janie has already walked away, and Sam is just standing there, and he says, like, I know I was drinking, but I saw what I saw.
Yeah.
And it's just, the way he said it, yeah, it's, you can't help but feel a little bit sympathetic for him.
You know, this is also where we get, I believe it is, this is where we get a wonderful little piece of mythology, which is something we haven't really had in a while.
Not in quite a bit.
Al points off into the distance and says about 30 miles that way, that's where Project Quantum Leap is going to be built, and he says definitively in 7 years.
In 7 years, 1989.
So we know, yeah, that Project Quantum Leap gets built in 1989.
Yeah, and it's one that, because when you think about it, it's like they start building it in 1989, Sam first sleeps in 1995. Like, there was 6 years of them just building stuff up and getting ready.
Yeah.
And then the leaping is just like the second part of it.
Right.
That's, you know, they talk about that in the novel Prelude. And I almost think, I don't know, like, looking off the top of my head, I think that scene may be cut in reruns. Yes,
it is. Yep.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. Yeah, Matt Dale's book, Beyond the Mirror Image, The Observer's Guide to Quantum Leap. he does indeed mention that that gets cut, unfortunately, in syndicated re-airings. And I agree, yeah, it is too bad, because it's one of those things that, you know, by today's television standards, with how serialized everything tends to be, you know, it's just this wonderful tidbit that would not be thrown away and left on the cutting room floor. So, thank goodness for DVD and streaming services.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we should also mention at this point, so Roberto and Janie have made a $50 bet that Roberto can't do a serious story. And it's also important to note that Janie is slumming it in Destiny, New Mexico because of her asthma, because of weather, she could not continue living in Chicago.
That's right. So the weather here was too much.
Yeah. Yep. And so that comes back into play.
Yes, it does.
Later on.
And so where do we go from there, Dennis?
Where do we go from there? We get to the plant pretty soon, because they go to it's more, they don't go to their, it's more like a fluff, like, public relations thing, isn't it? That they end up at the plant. Yeah. And that's where they first meet Rick Upfield, one of the plant workers with the damaged hand. He will play a victim later on. He is played by Marcus Giamatti. If you recognize that last name, it's because he is Paul Giamatti's older brother.
That's right. And in a neat little piece of trivia here that everyone can use to wow their friends, he would go on to co-star, or had already co-starred with.
Now
the dates are getting mixed up here. Had already co-starred with Mr. Scott Bakula in a little film called Necessary Roughness.
As Sergei Fumbelina Wilkins. Oh, yes. And he was also in another Rob Schneider film, because Rob Schneider has a bit role in Necessary Roughness before he really blown up and become Rob Schneider for whatever that is worth. He was also in The Chosen One with Rob Schneider.
That's right.
2010. Oh, apparently Rob Schneider's still doing stuff. Okay. God bless.
How about that?
God bless you, Rob Schneider.
He was also a regular on the television show Judging Amy, playing Peter Gray. I don't know enough about the show to determine exactly what his relation was to the main character, other than that I know that the main character's name is Amy Gray. So, could be brother, husband, cousin, I don't really know. All I know is that he was in that show with her, and yeah, there you have it. But he was in 138 episodes, so yeah, he was a regular for the whole run of the show.
Okay, yeah, I mean, yeah, it seems like he's working a lot there. But yeah, they get enough going on at the plant that there's something going on there.
Yeah, and his character in particular, you know, is obviously a big key to that because of the burn on his hand.
Yeah.
At least that's what Saxon wants us to think it is. And, you know, let's just give Marcus Giamatti some credit here, because in a role that does not have a lot of dialogue or screen time while he's alive, spoiler alert, he does a lot with it and creates a character that is, you know, sympathetic, that, you know, before his demise at the hit and run, you can almost, you know, you think that this character is going to, I don't know, that he's going to help them, that he's going to be, you know, along for the ride. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. I was surprised when he turned up dead, because I had forgotten that. Yeah. He gets dispatched pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. Just, you know, hey, that's the way it goes in these shows, right?
But that's the thing. Yeah. Is this pretty soon where we find ourselves back at the studio with the episode with, I know you want to talk about her.
Do we have to? Yeah, this is. So we get back, and he's got another episode, Roberto does, and it's about, you know, these bikini-clad models and whether or not their lack of clothing and desire to pose as pinups or whatever is demeaning to women and setting back, you know, feminism, blah-de-blah-de-blah, or whether or not it's empowering because they're making the choice to do it.
Yeah.
And the guest to be the counterpoint to, you know, yay, rah, take your clothes off, is none other than Dr. Laura Schlesinger, playing herself.
Yeah. Is this the first time in the show where we have a celebrity playing themselves? Other than Chubby Checker.
I was just getting ready to say, yeah, Chubby Checker. Yeah, I think so. I think that could be. I can't think of anyone else off the top of my head.
I mean, yeah, fifth season, all bets are off, but...
right. I mean, we've had some people, you know, appear via stock footage, like Warren Green in Disco Inferno and stuff, but yeah.
Sure.
I think that this is probably the first, like, in the flesh, if you will.
Sure. And this one is a lot more believable than Chubby Checker. Love Chubby Checker, but this one is actually a lot more believable.
Right.
Yeah. So, Dr. Laura, bless her heart, as they say. Bless her heart.
Yeah. She, you know, I just don't even, look, here's the thing. This woman thinks that homosexuality is a biological error. She has used racial slurs. I mean, I, whatever. The hell with her. I don't care. No. The best thing that ever came of her is the fact that she provided the fodder for the midterms episode of The West Wing, in which President Bartlet eviscerates a
stand-in, basically.
A stand-in, yeah, we'll use that word for her, the character of Dr. Jenna Jacobs.
Which is ironic, calling her a stand-in, because what draws Bartlett's ire in that scene is the fact that she refuses to stand for him.
That's right.
Which leads to his line that, in this White House, when the president stands, no one sits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, something that is, you know, well known, and something that Aaron Sorkin has never denied, is that the monologue that President Bartlet, as played by Martin Sheen, has, was actually based on an anonymous letter to Dr. Laura, which was, an email of the time that was going around because of Dr. Laura's comments about homosexuality and her racism, for lack of a better term. So I think she's a garbage human being right up there with Geraldo. So, hey, we got two garbage human beings
right there
that are, you know, referenced in this episode.
So to bring it back around, look, what an interesting thing about this is, so she ends up by the end of the scene, she dares Sam, Roberto, to do the rest of the episode in his boxers because of the argument that Sam is making, that just because women are scantily clad, they're not giving away any of their dignity. So, okay, well, if you believe that, you do it. It's interesting to note, this is noted in Matt's book, that in the first draft of the script, during this moment, Al reminds Sam that he had just played Hamlet in the nude a couple of leaps ago, and Sam does not remember that.
Yeah.
And of course, we're talking about the plays, the thing.
Right. Yeah. It is funny. Yeah. That he you know, talks about how humiliating this is. And like you said, it's, you know, he's clearly forgotten about the fact that he was appearing nude not too long ago. Which is also, you know, that's the thing that's interesting about this episode. And I think, you know, obviously having a writer like Chris Rupenthal and having, of course, you know, your star being the director as well, you get some really wonderful bits of continuity with the rest of the series. And, reinforcing the idea that Sam's memories get a little fuzzy in between leaps, that the Swiss cheesing is still a thing, that, you know, that even though it's not talked about and it's not mentioned and you know, we're certainly applying sort of 2019 TV logic and standards to a 1992 episode of television, but it also helps to explain the fact that he doesn't remember Donna. He doesn't remember a lot of this stuff. So it's, you know, it's just another cool little sort of Easter egg kind of thing in a way, that unfortunately is not as explicit as it would have been had that scripted exchange remained.
But, yeah.
But it's still there, and I think it's kind of neat little fodder for a Quantum Leap podcast.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then is this shortly thereafter where Rick, he contacts them? And
that's right. He gives them a call. He says, meet me at the Blue Dolphin.
Do you want to go to the Blue Dolphin?
Yeah. I want to go to the Blue Dolphin.
Let's go to the Blue Dolphin. Yeah, the Blue Dolphin line, it is a crack. There's kind of a hint of flirtiness between Roberto and Janie.
Yeah,
a little bit, which we come around to a little bit at the end, but not too much. But of course, by the time they get there, are they by the plant? Are they close to the Blue Dolphin? Was he crossing the street like on his way to the Blue Dolphin when he got hit, or was he just leaving the plant?
They're in the parking lot of the Blue Dolphin.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Which is really cool. You know, one thing that would be easy to gloss over, except for one particular instance that stands out a little bit later in the episode, is some of, you know, Scott's choices as a director. And again, I think probably, you know, when you work so closely with someone for so long, which obviously the executive producer and you know, frequent writer for the television program, you know, Scott and Chris would have a good relationship. So the opportunity probably to kind of craft some of these scenes together, in particular knowing that they were on a budget, I think that this is a great example of that, because the way that, you know, we've got kind of this crane shot coming through the parking lot, and immediately, you know, you're kind of like, oh, Blue Dolphin, they're going to meet there, but almost right away the rug gets pulled out from underneath of you, and you see the ambulance, and you see the flashing lights, yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, it's that wonderful sense of dramatic irony where you, the viewer, know, you just know without even having it explained to you or see it before the characters do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, of course, Sam and Janie get there, and we find out that Rick has been the victim of a hit and run.
Yeah. And what I love about, and it's peppered throughout the episode, but I feel like this is one of the first good instances, like the music is so 80s-tastic. It is so 1980s TV movie of the week.
Yeah.
Or any, or a Lifetime made for TV movie of any era. It's just got that, yeah. It's got that cheese to it, which I enjoy.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I want to throw this out here real quick. That, is it just me, or does the Roberto theme song sound a little bit like they were riffing on the Quantum Leap theme music?
Oh, God. Now that you say that, I think they were a little bit.
Right?
Yeah.
but you're right about the music in general. It is like that. You know, as a result of this scene, two big things happen. One, they find the key card, Rick's yeah. key card. The other thing that is, you know, not necessarily out of the ordinary, but for some reason it just really, it was arresting to me as a viewer, is that Sam just kicks it into high gear as far as like, all right, we're going to do this. We're figuring this out. We've got to do it now. We've got to go now. We got to, you know, he really all of a sudden just hurdles sort of the entire plot forward, and it's a wonderful example of Sam happening to the episode instead of the episode happening to Sam.
I see that, but also at the same moment, it occurred to me this scene could have worked just as well and maybe better if they had flip-flopped those lines, and instead Sam kind of naively says, we need to give this to the police, and Janie had been the one who said, no, you dumb hack. This is something that we can use and do some investigative journalism.
You know, if this were season one or two, I would absolutely agree with you.
But okay.
Being late season four, I think no. I think Sam should be the gas here.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough.
But I totally get your point, and I do agree that that would be interesting. One of the cool things that ends up happening from this, though, is that we get a wonderful conversation between Sam and Janie back at the news station as they're sort of kind of downloading all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to, I mean, one of my favorite Sam moments in a while, to be completely honest with you. You know, when she basically asks, how'd you get into this? And of course, that's Janie asking Roberto.
Yeah.
And instead of Sam replying as Roberto, Sam replies as Sam.
Yeah.
And he says, I got into this by accident. You know, I figured I wanted to, you know, now all of a sudden I'm champion for the underdog everywhere, you know, that sort of thing. It's just, it's a really, you know, great moment for him. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, Scott plays it perfectly. It's just this wonderful way of using his truth as a part of the Leapy's truth. And I think for someone who's so invested in the character, it's just this, it's kind of an emotional moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not played that way.
Sure.
It's not, but there is this,
I mean, they could have played at the cheese factor. They could have, they could have played the home theme.
Right. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Which, funny enough, and you mentioned this earlier, so all credit goes to you, and I'll let you actually talk about it, would have fit, honestly, if they would have gone the route of what was in the original script.
So in Matt's book, he points out that in the original script, during this scene, Sam talks about how his father sold the farm 6 months before he died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, it, you know, again, is just another wonderful callback. And I think it's in a way, it's too bad that that isn't in there. At the same time, it's interesting to know that it could have been. I don't miss it too much.
I know, but I mean, it also, and I'm just now thinking this popping off the top of my head, it really informs, like, if Sam's dad died of a heart attack, and if it just happened 6 months after he sold the farm, it just kind of plays into that idea of, like, once you don't have the thing that you live for.
Yeah.
You know, you, sometimes you just kind of choose to go.
Right.
In your own way. But yeah. Yeah, it's a nice. It's one of those things that I'm gonna take it away in my head canon. I'm gonna put it in there, and the
right.
I'm gonna put it in there in the episode now.
Absolutely.
So yeah. So now we're going back to the plant, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
we go back to the plant. They con their way in basically with Sam making up this story about Jamie's missing earring.
This is my one gripe with the episode.
Yeah.
But that's the story that they con their way in. It's almost like the guy knows that they're lying and he lets them in anyway.
You know, I think so. We talked about this off mic. I really do like this episode quite a bit. I think that perhaps the first half or so, maybe a little bit more than the first half, is pretty strong in a lot of respects. It's a great mix of different things that are great about Quantum Leap. There are some things that once we get to this point that just seem to be happening because we've got 45 minutes, we got to get somewhere. And this is definitely one of them. And I don't want to be as harsh as our friend over at the MacGyver Project.
Yeah.
Because he, like, just tears this thing apart.
Oh, like, my gosh.
He talks about, like, how terrible the last half of the episode is. The entire second half of the episode is a complete disaster.
Oh, my gosh.
The access that everyone has to the plant, et cetera, all this. And he says in his final analysis, as you can tell, I was not a fan of this one. It was a goofy plot and a slog to get through, and there was little in the way of highlights. Sorry, Scott. He ranks it fourth from the bottom of all episodes he had reviewed up to that point.
You know, I mean, yes. It does, like, how they're able to get back into the plant. How they're able to roam around the plant to begin with. And then how they're able to get back into the plant to fall on their face.
Right. Now, I will argue, actually, that the second half of that, though, makes a lot of sense to me. Because if you're Ed Saxton, who's this, you know, mastermind chemical weapons manufacturer or whatever, think about it from his point of view. I have the opportunity to bring these people that are breathing down my neck, who have clearly seen things they shouldn't see, into my plan and sucker them in much like Geraldo did with Al Capone's Fault,
sure,
to find a big nothing.
Yeah.
On live television.
Fair enough.
End of story, case closed, these guys are tabloid journalists, screw them, I'm going to go make another $1 million for killing poor kids in the Middle East with mustard gas.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Fair enough. Yes.
But, anyway.
but it is worth noting, so we do get a little bit of a Nate shot as they are driving around the plant after they find the thing, after they're making their way back out. In the original script, Al was just supposed to be sitting in the back seat of the little cart that they were on. Like they do with a lot of shots where Sam is driving somewhere, Al is just kind of positioned in the back seat. And I think you're just supposed to kind of accept that Al's not really sitting down. He's just positioned in the back seat of the car in such a way that he's going along with the vehicle. So Bakula had the idea to have Al actually floating along aside the golf cart. And so, they did some rearranging there to make that happen.
Yeah, and that was definitely one of the other things I wanted to talk about, because it's, you know, it is a really cool moment. I think that, you know, when you go into, like, just cool Al moments. We've had a couple recently, you know, I mean, even in Ghost Ship when he's like outside the plane and he walks in, and you know, there's some neat stuff that they've done with Al recently, mm-hmm. which I think is pretty cool.
I love every one of his outfits in this episode.
For sure.
And I also love Sam's red suit jacket.
Yes.
In the one scene. Mwah.
Mwah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. My, there you go, Jean-Pierre.
My compliments to Jean-Pierre.
So after this, of course, they find the dirt, if you will, and they make their way out just barely. It's kind of convenient that they let them go, because at this point, you know, they are kind of looking for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, they get out. And,
what's the name of the main henchman?
You know, I can't
remember his name, and
out.
I'm looking on IMDb, and it's either Michael Heitzman, Tim, or Victor Talmage, who is Foreman, or Hank. I feel like it was Tim, because he ends up playing a pretty significant part in the latter half of the episode.
He does, that's right.
And he's got these these creepy eyes. You just know he's bad news.
Yeah, right. He's you know, the wonderful thing is like he starts off as like kind of this doofus, you know, letting them in and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of playing like, you know, cool and everything. And then, yeah, it becomes very menacing. And in fact, is basically, you know, at the direction, of course, of Saxton, he is the cause of Janie's, what we find out would be her murder.
Yeah.
Because the thing that we failed to mention here, Jesus, some Quantum Leap co-hosts we are, is that one of the things that Sam is there to do is to stop Janie from dying.
Hey, if you're listening to this, you've seen the episode.
That's
you
true.
Know.
You've seen the episode.
You know. But in the original history, her car runs off the road, and in the changed history, she dies of an asthma attack.
Right.
Which, they telegraph that a lot, because she's having shortness of breath approximately every 1.5 minutes throughout the episode.
And she does end up using her inhaler earlier in the episode in front of Ed Saxton when they're doing the initial interview.
Yeah.
You know, kind of puff piece, like you were saying. So anyway, by this point, after they've escaped, you know, they're very adamant about getting there and doing the special, the expose. We get our Geraldo Al Capone vault moment as they get ready to go into the closet. There's no longer a slot for a key card there. Oh, speaking of which, back to the key card real quick. We get a very cool other piece of mythology, which Al lets Sam know that they used key cards early on at Project Quantum Leap before they had implanted, scanners or whatever put into their hands.
Yeah,
which was kind of cool bit there. But now instead of that door having a key card, it's got a regular lock on it. They open it and it's just a utility closet.
Yeah,
nothing there.
I do remember. I don't. I don't think as a kid, like, I realized, like, how much of this was a play on Geraldo's failed vault thing in real life. I do remember being intrigued and kind of, being intrigued is probably the right word, by when they go back, there's a fake closet that's been set up in place. I do think that that was a neat moment.
Yeah, yeah.
12-year-old me was impressed.
Right. And the other thing that's kind of cool, too, is that Al, you know, walks through the wall to examine the other side. And, of course, you can see that it's like, you know, well, they've got 6 feet of dirt piled up here. But, yeah, it's still a lair. Everything's all here. But, of course, there's nothing they can do. They get shut down. Alan Oppenheimer's character, Earl Skinner, the head guy, is like, hey, you know, cut him off, cut him off, cut him off. And at that point, you know, they get cut off. They go back to the newsroom very dejected. They're trying to figure out what in the world they could possibly do. And this is when they start hacking into the system, basically.
Yeah.
And, of course, they get found out.
Yep.
After Sam pulls some magic with Ziggy, getting into the system, they do get found out. And it's at this point that Saxton tells, who we believe is Tim, to, you know, take the inhaler, basically, and kill Janie.
Well, he doesn't say that. He's just like, we got it. I love this moment because, like, you kind of see, like, the evilness of Saxton. He's like, no, like, for one, Tim is ready to kill them both. And he's like, no, just take out the reporter. Like, he, basically, Roberto's just a hack. You kill her off, he'll learn. We'll throw some money at him. He'll go away. You kill her. She's the dangerous one.
Right.
And then he's like, you got to be more. He basically says you got to be more creative. And you see him thinking, because like he's standing in the foreground. Tim is standing in the background. And he's thinking. And then he gets a smile on his face. And he knows how it's going to happen, but we don't quite know yet. And then we cut back. Sam is working on the computer. Janie has fallen asleep, and this we see Tim replace the inhaler. And this is another a little remnant of every murder that happens in like any kind of piece of 1980s television: the leather gloves.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a nice bit of cheese, and it is one of the things that draws some criticism not only on the MacGyver Project but on Al's Place message boards about the fact that he replaces the inhaler like right behind Sam as Sam is like typing away on the computer. And it's one of those things where it's like, man, that guy's a ninja. He's walking against the wind.
It's like how did he break? Well, I mean, they know that they're probably at the news office because they've caught them hacking into the computer. And so Sam is trying to rehack back in. And right. So I can buy that. So to me, what is going on in that scene is that off camera, between Sam and Al, they figure out, between Sam and Al and Janie even, like they, well, between Sam and Al, because they know she's going to die by asthma attack.
Right.
They figure out what's happening. And so I think what we don't see off camera, it's because they're saving the twist for us, the viewer, at the end. I think Sam knows when Tim comes in. I think Al is in the room. And I think Al is in the room, and Al's like, okay, he's coming. He's coming. Everyone be quiet. Janie's pretending to be asleep. Because they know he's not going to kill him. He's not going to hurt him right then. They know he's going to kill her with the inhaler. So Sam is pretending not to hear him. Janie's pretending to be asleep. Al is standing somewhere off camera giving them a heads up. And that's how they do it.
That is, bravo. I love that. No, seriously, I love that. And I did not, and for whatever reason, you know, in 20 plus years, I never thought of it that way. But that makes perfect sense. And I really like that. It's a wonderful, it plays into the fact that they've been suckering them in the whole time. And I wouldn't be a damn bit surprised if that's exactly what, you know, Chris and Scott wanted from this, if it wasn't, you know, if that wasn't kind of the intent all along. But obviously not wanting to tip their hand early and ruin the twist, you know, they play it cool like this. But yeah, that makes so much sense, and I really like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise it's just a horrible scene. You know?
Yeah.
So we cut to Sam calling Saxton and playing it full tilt. How'd you do it?
Yeah.
How'd you kill
it? What a great, like, it's still 80s cheese, like we've been talking about. Like, it's still got some of that element to it. But still, what a great scene. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just a great phone call. And I love the kicker at the end. When Sam, like, suckers him into coming on the show and to write him a check for $100,000. Yeah. And the fact that, like, Saxton is like, I knew I had your number. Yeah. Like, yeah.
I don't think when I was a kid, like, when he was talking about the scholarship, I don't think I fully appreciated the wink-wink of scholarship. I'll make it out to you. I'll let you handle it however you see fit.
Yeah.
I never caught when I was a kid, like, he was, wink, wink, paying off Roberto.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's funny because for whatever reason, I didn't end up getting to watch this on the Blu-rays, and my stream, for whatever reason, kind of died. And
you should get that checked out. We're getting that age.
Yeah, you know. Oh, dad, God. Somebody give him a rim shot.
Dad jokes are built in.
So,
I'm hitting 40, so it's time to start visiting the proctologist. So, yes.
That's right, man.
Rim shot, here we go. Anyway, you were saying.
So I had to rewind this scene a couple of times because it kept kind of getting choppy or whatever. So I actually literally saw that particular moment like three times in a row just because of the way that it was getting choppy. So I got to get quick succession of Saxton paying Roberto off.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway... We, you know, fast forward here to the next day, and now Saxton is coming on Roberto's show. Sam, of course, you know, plays it up to the hilt about, a reporter making a mistake, etc., all this sort of stuff. He's very contrite. He's also very sad. He announces the death of Janie. Here's the interesting thing. Everyone in the room, including old Ed Skinner, our editor-in-chief guy, like...
Store brand Lou Grant.
Yes. But they are all, like, so crestfallen, so sad. Some of them are shocked. Like, some people don't seem to know that she's dead. Uh-huh. And they're like, whoa, my God, she died? Oh, no. So there's this pall that's hanging over everything. He starts in on Saxton and everything, eventually pulls out the inhaler, suckers him in by spraying the inhaler in his face. He's like, no, don't worry, this is just a regular inhaler. Of course, it's at that point the door is open, and here comes Janie and the cops.
Actually, Janie walks in before.
Okay.
Janie walks in. That's how Saxon knows that the gig is up, and then he sprays it into his face.
That's right. I flipped it.
It's okay.
But when she walks in with the cops, oh, my God. Like, everyone in the room is like, huh? She's alive? Including Skinner. Like, everyone who works at the station. It's like, Jesus. Like, I get that you guys wanted to sucker him in, but you really didn't let anyone in on the... You let all of these people think she was dead?
But plausible deniability.
Hey, man, commitment to the bit. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And, the jig is up, and, so, yeah, everything is going to turn out. Janie actually walks up and serves the search warrant.
That's right.
Yeah, which is, I find a little bit unbelievable, but hey, you know, that Janie's the one who serves the warrant. But anyway, it's nice. It's dramatic. Saxton storms off. The police follow him. And in the little wrap-up that Al gives us, everything's going to turn out okay.
A-okay. And we get that great bit as Sam's talking about the on tomorrow's episode.
Yes. So we're talking about this off mic. I don't know if I'd forgotten about this joke or I've never gotten the joke. But the last thing he says is like, oh, and my personal story of how I was once or how I was kidnapped by aliens and kept in an all-white room. I didn't get the joke until they cut to Al and him and Al kind of share a look. And I'm like, oh, you clever bastards. They're talking about the waiting room.
Yeah. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. It's, you know, it's just, like I said, it's little bits like that throughout this episode that I feel like kind of do end up elevating the episode a bit. It's not, you know, again, it's not a great episode by any stretch. It's, I don't think I would necessarily say it's one of my favorites of season four. It's probably towards the, you know, the bottom of the top half of episodes of the season. Maybe a little higher than that, but it's just got some really great texture. It's got some excellent direction by Scott Bakula. It's, you know, overall, it, you know, it's got a good plot. It speeds by. And yeah, we get our little wrap up. We get Sam talking to Janie here, offering to buy her a bottle of champagne. And then we get the leap out, which is worth noting here that in the original airing, it was actually a leap out into Raped, a rerun of Raped, and that the next episode, of course, which has been restored in the leap out for streaming and on the Blu-rays and DVDs, is into the next episode, which, of course, is It's a Wonderful Leap.
Yes. Yes. Oh, we have so much to talk about in that episode.
Dear God. If you thought I said, do we have to in this one? So anyway.
Hey, you know, we get to talk about a very clever bit that Stephen Colbert did.
Yep.
On the Colbert Show with Scott Bakula, who is a good sport and came back and reprised Sam. So, yeah.
Which is, you know, which is lovely that we get to talk about something like that for awful, horrible reasons. Terrifying reasons, but it's wonderful because it reminds us that as we sit here doing this podcast about our favorite show, that, you know, Quantum Leap in its time on the air did make an indelible mark on pop culture.
Oh yeah,
that there are a lot of people out there that have heard of the show, that know the show, seen an episode here or there or whatnot, but people who've never seen the show still are aware of the show in one fashion or another, which is pretty cool. But yeah, the leap out, he's driving a cab, he's looking around, playing with his glasses, trying to figure out where, when he is, and he ends up hitting somebody. I mean, and let me just say, that the way he hits her, like, he runs her over. Like, the car's, like, up and over, and, like, man.
The car's up and over, and actually, like, part of the car, like, bumper, like, comes loose a little bit. Yeah, it's gonna be fun to talk about. Let's wrap this up, and I'll talk about some odds and ends and other stuff. So you thought this is a solid, not one of your favorite episodes. I think this episode had the benefit of kind of being like not very great in my memory, and so it was a pleasant surprise.
I get that.
Yeah, I enjoyed this episode more than I have the last couple ones.
I don't know. It's interesting because I can't necessarily say I disagree with that, but I think I'd probably put it above Song for the Soul, and it might edge out, you know, Last Gunfighter ever so slightly. There's some stuff I really enjoyed about Last Gunfighter, actually, but I think I'd put it above Last Gunfighter. I agree with you. I'd put it above Ghost Ship as well. So, you're right. You're right. When you're right, you're right.
You're right. I mean, Ghost Ship, it has the allure of the Bermuda Triangle.
Right.
But this one was just... Yeah, I liked all the cheesy twists and turns in the latter half of this episode versus them throwing crap out of an airplane at the end of Ghost Ship.
Yeah.
Well,
and one thing I will say is that I feel, for no particular reason other than that I'm just kind of making this supposition right now, that season four overall, in spite of some weaker episodes, you know, at times, has actually, I think, held up probably better than season three overall.
I may have to agree with that.
I think season three has the stronger, like, home run episodes.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you've got Leap Home Part 1 and 2. You've got Black and White on Fire. But yeah, I mean... there are some other ones in there, sure, but for the most part, that's about all you get.
Yeah.
And like, and season four has had some really solid episodes. I think that the consistency of season four is what ends up making it stand out over season three, in spite of season three having some big
knockout episodes.
Yeah.
Tell us what you think, listeners.
Please do.
Which is more solid? We'll put a thing up. Which is more, yeah, three or four. So anyway, so odds and ends. So, and I'm sure after we wrap up the main episodes, we'll get into talking about this, but the novels. I recently reread Double or Nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Short review, because we'll get into it deeper later on. It was a great concept. It had its moments. But, oh.
Yeah.
It's... I like Verbena Beeks. I like how the waiting room is portrayed in the books better than I do the series. Because the waiting room in the series is like this weird blue room with just a big table in the middle of the room with a giant mirror in the middle, which makes no damn sense. Whereas in the novels, the waiting room is a very clinical, timeless-looking hospital room where they actually do have the Leapy, like, hooked up to, you know, IVs and things and monitors and everything, which makes more sense. I like Beeks, and I like how the waiting room is portrayed. I don't think this particular writer knew how to write Al at all. And it just,
you know, it's funny because I think that was the first one that I ever bought.
Yeah.
At B. Dalton Booksellers. No, oh, maybe yeah. I bought it at Walden's.
Where I bought online, yeah.
I remember it being the first one that I bought. Actually, my mom bought it for me, but I don't remember a whole lot about it, you know. It was one of those things, you know, I was always taking books to school with me.
Yeah.
While most kids were, you know, trying to catch up on homework or whatever, I was saying the hell with that and reading Quantum Leap novels.
Yeah.
But, I think that... it'll be interesting to revisit the novels because there are some that I've never read. There's some that I've never finished. And then there are, you know, the handful that I have read. And that was one of the first ones. But I don't, frankly, remember much about it.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I know that the quality, you know, kind of varies pretty wildly between books. You know, some are really good, some are meh, and some are not good at all.
Yeah. There's what I do appreciate about the books, and we've talked about this before a lot on the podcast, is that a lot of the books break away from the series and that they have Sam's mind leap instead of the body. And I think on TV it makes sense why they chose the body, but in the novel where you're not constrained by a budget and you can do more interesting things just on the written page, I think having Sam's mind leap is a much better choice.
Yeah.
The whole premise of this novel that we're talking about, Double or Nothing, Sam's mind is split in two and he leaps into adult twins.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Great premise, not executed well.
Yeah. You know what? I am absolutely lying. It wasn't Double or Nothing. It was Too Close for Comfort.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That was my first one, and that was the one that I read. Double or Nothing is one of the ones that I've never read before. But I know the premise, so yeah. You know, it's interesting because one of the things that they do brilliantly set that up in the very first novel, which is, of course, the novel or Carney knowledge.
Depending on
which side of the pond you're on. But is that, yeah, almost immediately, like within the first chapter, it's set up that it's Sam's mind that leaps because, of course, his character has a physical impairment. And they talk about Sam kind of having to deal with that, which is really interesting.
Well, I can't remember. I think it may have been the second novel. I think it may have been in the preface to Too Close for Comfort, the writer Ashley McConnell, who also wrote the novel, or Carney Knowledge, she just flat out acknowledges, like, yes, I realize the series said the body, I'm saying the mind, and her reasoning was that the first season of the TV series, it was kind of ambiguous.
It was.
And not well explained, so she was like, I decided to run with the ambiguity and go the other direction.
Yeah, and she, you know, and to be fair, you know, she really kind of was the, you know, one of the driving forces behind the novels. She wrote the lion's share of them. She kind of helped come up with some of the more bigger picture ideas that were explored within the context of the novels. She didn't necessarily write like all the great ones, like Angels Unaware and Pulitzer were written by another author, L. Elizabeth Storm. But she did kind of early on sort of craft the direction, I feel like, of the novels with a lot of her decisions that other authors, you know, definitely picked up on and went with. It'll be interesting to get there, and it'll be interesting to talk a little bit, I think, when we get there too, about just sort of genre novels in general, because they're fascinating to me, you know, as someone who's consumed a few in his time, whether it be Quantum Leap or Star Trek or Star Wars or Doctor Who. Oh God, Doctor Who. I think that it'll be kind of interesting to touch on some of that stuff. I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to having a weekly reading assignment.
Yes. The thing is, like, when I would buy these books, it got to a string where they were always being released around Christmas time. So, like, they were, the yearly novel was like my Christmas present, or one of the novels was my Christmas present for the year. And, like, the rest of Christmas Day, I would just sit there and I would just read the book in one setting. And that was it. Mm. And that's the thing about genre books. Not a deep read.
Right.
You can easily consume it in a day.
Yeah, absolutely. That is very true. I think of the Quantum Leap books and a lot of those, especially like some of the early like pocket, you know, Star Trek novels, you know, that were, I mean, in some cases even under 200 pages. So it was definitely an afternoon or a couple of hours. But lots to say. I always have lots to say, naturally. Of course, why this podcast is what it is. But I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about it. I think it could be fun.
Same. Oh, sorry. YouTube channel popped up. Never mind.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, what is happening?
What are we going to do?
Unless you have anything else to add, though, I think I'm...
I'm ready to go. Let's see about it. You got a crying baby that we had to pause for and jump out.
She's being soothed right now, but I'm about ready to go upstairs and take over because it's that's my duty at this point in the evening.
You know, that's this has been an ongoing thing with thank you for listening. We're just talking about dad stuff here. Hang around if you're interested in the dad stuff. If not, just skip ahead a few seconds to "I'm just a traveler." For quite a while we've been in this pattern where Harrison will wake up in the middle of the night and he'll go back to sleep. Some nights he'll go back to sleep pretty easy. Other nights he'll be just kind of like up and restless for 2 or 3 hours, and Betsy and I just take turns staying in the room, sleeping with him. And
it's kind of, she's in a phase right now where she just, it's so strange because she definitely doesn't want to be put down, but she's also not making it super easy to hold her. Like, it used to be that it was just very easy to just kind of, like, you know, cradle her on my chest or cradle her in my arms, and she would just sleep, and I could just hold her like that if she didn't want to be put down.
Yeah.
But now she's, like, she's just kind of moving around, wiggling around, and she's asleep, sort of-ish, but she's not, you know, she's not really settling. It's, you know, it is what it is. That's parenthood, right?
That's what it is. That's why we went from being a weekly podcast to a couple times a month.
Whenever we damn well feel.
To whenever we can get to a microphone. But go ahead.
I was going to say, for me, it's just all about, it's about extending our joy.
Yes.
You know, it's why rush to the finish line when we can leisurely lumber our way to the...
We're going to leisurely get there. We're going to get some guests back on the episode at some point.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe even for It's a Wonderful Leap.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll throw that out there. All right. Well, have a good night. Give my love to the family.
Absolutely. You do the same.
All right.
It's always good to see you. Good to talk to you, my friend.
You as well. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Hit us up. Talk to us. Tell us what you think about season 4 versus season 3. And we'll hopefully be doing this again real soon.
Yeah. Talk to y'all soon. Bye.
Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time.
Can't see.